Today, why environmental journalists are being killed for their work. And Polly Toynbee on Jeremy Hunt and Boris Johnson making it to the final in the Tory leadership race. This story starts with a lake in Guatemala, the fishermen who work on it, and the mine that they believe is poisoning it. A mine that supplies us with nickel.
They demanded tests and samples and scientific studies. They felt they weren't getting the answers. And they were worried that the problems were coming from a refinery at a nickel mine on the shores of the lake. The nickel mine says that it's got no involvement, it's got no connection to this problem. But the fishermen weren't, they didn't trust what the authorities were telling them. They didn't trust what the company was telling them. And they wanted answers.
The fishermen were alarmed about the presence of the mine and worried about its impact on the lake.
And they'd put up a barricade, and the barricade was stopping the mine exporting what it was digging out of the ground.
And the fishermen put up a barricade?
They did. They blocked the road. They blocked the road down to the Caribbean, where this company puts its ore and its nickel on ships, and they sail off to Asia and to Europe.
Carlos Choc is a reporter, and he went to cover the story of their protest.
He was in a small town in called El Estor in Guatemala on the day of a big demonstration. Police arrived to close it down. He was there with his camera, and he and a number of other witnesses saw police shoot a fisherman, a demonstrator, dead.
That incident has changed Carlos's life forever. Stories like this can be a complex mixture of climate change, deforestation, intensive agriculture, as well as the physical impact of these mineral industries on local environments. All of which produces pressures and conflicts between local communities and those in power. And journalists can be beaten up, harassed, and even murdered. Juliet Garside is an investigative reporter for The Guardian, and Jonathan Watts is the Global Environment Editor, and they've been part of a new report into the dangers these stories hold.
There needs to be more scrutiny, there needs to be more accountability on something that we take for granted. We think we get all these wonderful things that are around us, our laptops, our phones, our TVs. From where? From exactly these sorts of places.
From The Guardian, I'm India Rackerson. Today in Focus, why has the environmental frontline become so dangerous? Juliet, this journalist, Carlos Choc, you met him. What's he like?
He's quite quiet, very composed. He was a single father for 5 years, looking after his children. His wife had started another family. So he found himself in charge of a four-year-old and a five-year-old, and had to learn how to wash clothes and cook and play dolls with his son and brush his daughter's hair and get their kit ready for school.
Did he talk to you about his family then?
A lot. I met him with his son, and they were going to the beach to play guitar together.
So after the shooting, what happened?
Carlos, that afternoon, started getting calls from the Guatemalan TV stations saying, we hear there's been violence in El Estor. We hear someone's been killed. The authorities are denying it. What's going on? And he was able to confirm, as an eyewitness, that a fisherman had been shot dead and another had been wounded. So he went on national TV and he was talking about it. He was reporting it and he was contradicting what the police spokesman was saying. The police initially denied there'd been a death. And they still deny drawing their weapons that day.
So that must have been pretty exposing then for the police.
Yeah, massively.
He started hearing rumours that he was facing an arrest warrant. He was summoned to a hearing where he was accused of being part of the fishermen's trade union, a protester, and he was accused too of illegally detaining company staff against their will, all of which he strenuously denies.
What happened?
They never referred to him as a journalist.
But he is very, obviously very publicly, a journalist in Guatemala.
Yeah, and he's not a member of any fishermen's union.
When Carlos left the court after his hearing, he spotted the police waiting outside. They were asking everybody where he was.
He slipped out because he just looked like any other reporter.
Carlos's friends bundle him into a car.
And they drove him to the capital, to Guatemala City.
That's when he went into hiding.
He spent a year in hiding. The charges were trumped up, from what we can see. But he was facing jail time. And prisons in Guatemala are not somewhere you want to be when you have political forces who want to silence you.
And what about the company who run the mine? Were they interested in his whereabouts?
Those charges were made by the public prosecutor, but they were made following interviews with company staff who, in their witness statements, must have implicated Carlos.
John and Juliet are part of a global project called Green Blood, made up of media organisations working together to take on stories that have become too dangerous for local journalists to cover alone. You went to Guatemala, didn't you, to see the mine. What was it like around there?
We went with this fantastic guy translating for us, and he described us as entering through the gates of Mordor. It's an open cast mine, and so they chop down all the trees and they nibble away at the mountain with these diggers and expose this really red earth that's beneath the topsoil, and that's what they dig out. Nothing grows and there's dust everywhere.
You've talked about violence and a threat for journalists in Guatemala. How did it feel for you when you were there?
We had a slight flavour of what it's like, this criminalisation process. When we were there, we wanted to interview. We went to the courthouse and we wanted to interview the judge. He'd cancelled Carlos's hearing again that day. And he wouldn't meet with us. And we were ushered out by the clerks and they told us, "You've committed a criminal offence." And we said, "Well, we'd like to interview the judge." And his clerk came, spoke to us a bit later and said, "Okay, he's going to give you an interview. Can we have your IDs?" So we handed over our press cards and she took them away and photocopied them. And then she came back and she said, "Actually, he's not going to give you an interview. And I would just like to remind you that we do now have your IDs and you have committed a crime here in this court today."
So what crime was it that they said you'd committed?
It wasn't specified. They said, "You're not allowed to come in like that into a courtroom. You've committed a crime."
Obviously, the purpose of your trip was to work with Carlos and continue his reporting.
So, yes, I spent the rest of the week with Carlos and we were talking to the communities near the mine. On our side, we were able to help by, for example, getting access to people like the mining minister. And that can be a hard thing to do when you don't have a big newspaper behind you and you're being threatened with a court case. But one of the big things that Carlos was able to help us do is to map these previously unmapped communities in and around the mine. So what we hope is this will put pressure on the mine owner, on Solway. We want to make it harder for them to ignore these people.
Okay, so Carlos was covering the story of this mine, and we all use the stuff that comes out of this mine, nickel. So let's talk about products. Where does the nickel from the mine go?
We know that it goes into steel mills that make stainless steel in Europe and Asia. We've asked the company whose mills they supply, and we've asked them what objects are made, and they won't say.
So you asked them?
We asked them, and they said it was commercially confidential.
Journalists are covering stories of mining facilities all across the world that are mining minerals and metals that we all use. But what other sorts of products do they go into?
When you're talking about metals, it could be the gold that ends up in your iPhone. It could be, in the case of nickel, not in our particular mine, but in the case of nickel, it's a growth industry because it's used in the batteries of electric cars, of eco-friendly electric cars.
So, John, you're the global environment editor and you frequently cover these types of stories. It sounds like as we want more and more of a product, the threat level will continue to rise. Is that right?
The bigger picture is that as there is more people in the world, as there is more demand for more products, and as those products become scarcer and harder to get, there's more tension surrounding them and more tension leads to often more conflict and often more difficulty in getting access to the information about what's happening, how to do this properly, how to make it more sustainable, how to compensate the people who are losing out. All those issues, which are where journalists should play an important role, can become very difficult if local politicians or business people feel that they're going to have less profits.
So, John, you travelled to Tanzania to investigate one of the biggest mines in the country. It's a gold mine. What's happening there?
The North Mara gold mine. It was evident as soon as you arrived that there is a problem of proximity, that people are living too close to the mine, too close to the tailings reservoir where all the contaminated water is kept.
I should say, it's a huge mine. Like, I had a look at it on Google Maps and you can see it on satellite view from quite far out, can't you?
These structures, these tailings reservoirs, if they call them, are some of the biggest man-made structures on the planet. And they're all over the world. And most people only see them, if at all, if they fly over them or if they look on Google Earth. And there's a reason for that. One of them is they're so big you can't see them unless you're right at the above them. And the other is that there is supposed to be, in Tanzanian law at least, a 200-metre buffer zone between the mine and where people live.
In many areas around the site, the mine has been able to acquire the land needed for the 200-metre buffer zone. But as there is no compulsory acquisition process in Tanzania, many landowners within this zone are refusing to sell.
And what this means is that people are more likely to be exposed to contamination. And many of the people I spoke to complained of skin rashes. Doctors said that they'd seen lots of cases that made them very worried about the health impacts. There are recorded instances of contamination leaking from the mine in the past.
There were the health problems because of the contamination, but the boundary also became violent. Police and security guards were frequently accused of shooting and raping people.
The mine is rich and full of gold. The local people who used to mine before the mine came there are suddenly shut out from one of their main sources of income. And so they try to get back in, and this leads to all sorts of tension and violence.
Between 2010 and 2014, the local hospital was treating between 5 and 8 cases of gunshot wounds a week.
The police were largely responsible for many of the killings that had taken place in the last 10 years or so. And there were difficulties for local journalists to go and investigate, because when they tried to do that, the authorities cracked down on them and in 4 cases closed down media organisations completely. And there were also reports of detentions and one foreign journalist being deported even.
Right, so, well, what happened?
They kept writing the stories. Then lawyers came along and offered to represent some of the people who claimed to have suffered human rights abuses or rapes or murders, beatings. And this sort of changed the way the mine operated. They were getting unwanted attention in the courts, in the press. And there has been an improvement at that mine in many respects in the last 2 or 3 years, partly as a result of all this pressure that's been put on them. There's still a way to go. But I think this process of transparency, accountability, scrutiny by the media, scrutiny by lawyers and the courts, it can have some results, and there are less deaths compared to the past.
13 environmental journalists around the world have been killed because of their work in the last decade. But the Committee to Protect Journalists says it's looking globally at another 16 cases.
With those kind of numbers, you're talking about a subject that is probably second or third only to reporting about armed conflict or reporting about narco trafficking in terms of the level of danger and the kind of the power and aggression of the enemies that you're taking on.
This is just the extreme edge of violence. And in fact, there are many different layers of intimidation and threats that are used below that, before that. Often pressure on newspaper editors, often censorship, putting people out of jobs. There's all sorts of ways stories can be squashed.
So who is responsible for this?
It's very rarely the case that the big mine or the big processing facility is behind the killings. Generally, that's bad for their shareholders. That's bad for their international image. But what happens is this huge presence moves into an area and disrupts everything completely. And you will get always a group of powerful people whose interests are served by making this a success and stopping anyone who's opposing it. And so it's this sort of knock-on effect. These big public international corporations, they aren't usually directly involved, but it is their presence that has changed the whole balance in those regions and caused all these dynamics that lead to the violence and the crackdown.
Okay, so let's talk about these big companies. It was really interesting when I was looking into the North Mara mine where you visited, and the company that runs it, their headquarters is like just a 40-minute walk from us right here in London.
Acacia Mining, which is London listed and is in turn 64% owned by the world's biggest gold mining company, Barrick, which is based in Toronto. So you get this, you can see that huge international players are involved that aim to set or say they are setting international top standards. And one of the missions we had was to go out there and see if that's really the case. There's often one standard that is applied in your home country and another standard that is applied thousands of miles away in a remote area of a developing nation. Canada, as Prime Minister Trudeau is sort of claiming to be a sort of very green, environmentally friendly leader.
But I've always known that when it comes to our environment, we Canadians get it.
On some issues, he is. But it's also the case that the apparently once clean countries like Canada and Australia and the UK, these are the three of the countries that have some of the biggest mining interests in the world.
It's a really old, ancient European way of doing business. If you think about the sugar fortunes that were made in England, slavery was illegal. There was no slavery in England, but those fortunes were made by English families from slave plantations in the Caribbean. This double standards, it's a very ancient way of extracting profit.
And it's still going on.
And it's still going on and not as bleak, but it's still happening.
The Green Blood Project will continue to put pressure on governments and companies to try and make it safer for environmental journalists like Carlos to keep reporting.
Después de todo lo que pase, considero no solo creer, sino que considero que este es mi lugar.
So, Juliet, what's happening for Carlos now?
Well, in January, the public prosecutor asked for the charges to be dropped. The company even agreed, but the judge refused to close the case. He did agree, however, to lift the detention order against Carlos, and Carlos was allowed to return home. But he's still facing trial for a crime that he says he didn't commit.
When you met Carlos, he was still working as a journalist and still covering stories like this, but writing under a pseudonym. What drives him to keep on at these stories?
I think he's been really well supported and he knows it's the right thing to do. So he's got the strength and he's got the courage.
Juliet, John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
We asked the companies Acacia and Solway for their response. Acacia said, "The company and the mine would like to make it clear that they had not been aware of any allegations of intimidation, harassment and threats against journalists and thoroughly condemn any such incidents. They say that the mine's private security personnel do not have access to live, lethal ammunition." They added that the mine requires its personnel and contractors and expects other third parties to seek to ensure that the human rights of the mine's local community members are respected. They added, we would like to underline the significantly improved social situation at North Mara since 2014. Solway says that it values freedom of speech, supports investigative journalism, and aims for transparency in its communications. They say, "We never intimidate any media and have never tried to silence any reporting on our activities." They added, "We do not approve of and we strongly condemn all kinds of illegal activity. Any involvement of the company in the legal cases that were mentioned was motivated purely by our obligation to defend our employees' rights and was limited to this." The Green Blood Project is organised by Forbidden Stories, who worked with John and Juliet on the investigations and films, and you can find them, along with the articles on the full Green Blood series, at theguardian.com. Coming up, we're down to Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt in the Conservative Party leadership race, and Polly Toynbee has some thoughts on that. Now, at 6 p.m. last night, we had these results.
The total number of votes given to each candidate were as follows. Michael Gove, 75. Jeremy Hunt, 77. Boris Johnson, 160.
Jeremy Hunt will join Boris Johnson on the ballot to be sent out to around 160,000 Conservative Party members. And they alone, will now determine who will be Britain's next Prime Minister. The Guardian's Polly Toynbee weighs up the choice.
I doubt if very many people in the country were waiting with bated breath for this very exciting not result between two quite boring people as to which of them is not going to be Prime Minister when both of them are not going to be Prime Minister. Plainly, skullduggery was going on, and that's going to be the big story. Team Boris Johnson will have made sure that some of their people lent votes to Jeremy Hunt because they didn't want to be up against Gove, because Gove is a much sharper opponent. Gove is a sinuous, Slytherin sort of character, very courteous, very intelligent, and it's quite possible that Gove would have landed quite a few blows on Boris, whereas Hunt, I think, will be much more straightforward. Hunt was intensely disliked in the health service. Every Monday morning he had bullying meetings in which he used to summon the heads of any trusts who were not doing well enough. He would pick up the phone at random times and shout at people, terrified chief executives of hospitals. He's a pretty ferocious character. He was not well liked. On the other hand, not many people survive the sort of hardship that the NHS has been through during his 6 years. The question is, what should Hunt do now? How does he best oppose Boris Johnson? If he was clever and if he was brave, and he may not be either of those things, I think his clever act would be to call out Boris Johnson for all of the lies that he tells. He could be saying, "All right, Johnson, you just tell us how it is you're going to get out of Europe on October the 31st. How is it you're going to do it without crashing out? And if you crash out, what kind of preparations have you made?" I don't think he will, because he's already up to his neck in Brexitry, and I don't think he'd dare retreat to a more Remain-y position. For Boris Johnson, there's nothing to do but be affable, to be likeable, and to survive without ludicrous jokes, racisms, all of the things that we're used to him tumbling into. Who's going to be voting now? 160,000 very odd people. This is the Conservative Party gone mad. They look very normal. They look like ordinary Rotarians, golf club types, pillars of their local community. But in fact, they've all lost their marbles. A YouGov poll on Wednesday shockingly showed that a sort of two-thirds majority of Conservative Party members are quite happy to see Scotland go independent, Northern Ireland join the South. They're quite happy to see the economy suffer significant damage. Those were the words. And they're quite happy to see their own party trash just in order to get Brexit. Brexit is a kind of virus that has taken hold of them, where they will sacrifice all of us, everything, just to get this mystical, magical, unicorn-like thing. And now we all have to sit by, helpless, and watch this group choose a most unsuitable man to be our Prime Minister. I never thought we'd reach this point. I never could imagine Boris Johnson, a sociopath, a liar, a cheat, could end up being our Prime Minister, but that looks like our fate.
You can hear more from Polly Toynbee and keep up to date on Britain's next Prime Minister at theguardian.com. That's all for today. My thanks to Polly and to Juliet Garside, Jonathan Watts, the team at Forbidden Stories, and also to Ekaterina Ochagavia. Today's programme was produced by Lucy Greenwell and Mithali Rao. The sound design is by Axel Kakutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back on Monday.